This is Fresh Air. Anyone who wants to adopt a child is usually warned they'll have a hard time getting a baby. My guest, Elizabeth Barthollet, is the author of the new book Family Bonds, on the politics of adoption, a subject she knows about from personal experience and from her work as a professor at Harvard Law School. She gave birth to a boy when she was married and in her 20s, but when she was in her 30s and single, she wanted to have another baby and found out her IUD had left her infertile. After years of infertility treatment, she decided to adopt. But the obstacles she faced adopting in America led her to consider foreign adoption. When she was 45, as her birth son was leaving for out-of-town college, she flew down to Peru to adopt a baby. 2 years later, she returned and adopted another son.
Part of why I didn't look into adoption as early as I might have is that I wasn't even certain that as a single person I could adopt. And when I did first look into it, I found a variety of very typical discouraging messages that it would be incredibly difficult, that the typical agencies wouldn't take me or would put me at the bottom of the list or would only let me adopt a much, much older child. So those were discouraging early messages. But I found that once I decided I was going to do it, once I quit the treatment road and threw myself into it, that it's like any other thing you throw yourself into, you can pretty quickly find out how it works. And I think one of the important messages about adoption is that unlike infertility treatment, you can achieve your goal. If you set out to be a parent, you can become a parent. Whereas with infertility treatment, there's really no control you exert over what in fact is going to happen. And in fact, for most people, they're not going to succeed in producing the pregnancy thereafter.
Now, you teach law at Harvard Law School.
I do.
But you write that in the adoption world, you experienced the law as something that prevented good things from happening. What were the laws that you just couldn't comprehend that were standing in your way?
Well, first, as an overall matter, the way the law structures adoption is to set up barriers. The barriers are there supposedly in the, quote, best interest of children. But in fact, all the laws are designed really to make adoption difficult. They're based on the premise that something is likely to go wrong when a child is turned over from one parent to another for the purpose of raising. And that's my first and major problem with the law. The next thing I discovered was that something very surprising to me as a civil rights lawyer. As a civil rights lawyer, I had discovered that the world largely, at least on an official basis, prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, age, disability, and to a significant degree, marital status. Now, in the adoption world, it is exactly those factors that are the primary determinants of who's allowed to parent and which child they are allowed to be matched up with if they are found minimally fit for parenting.
How did you rate as a potential parent? You were in your 40s, you were single, you had a great profession.
Bottom of the barrel. For the first time in my life, I discovered that my credentials were lousy. I was really not the absolute bottom of the barrel. Gays and lesbians, of course, are often, usually in this country, found not even to cross that minimal fitness threshold. People with very serious disabilities would be below me, but a single person in her 40s is very low.
You adopted your first baby in 1985, and this was in Peru.
Mm-hmm.
And you write about the odd dilemmas of choice that you face in adoption. I don't know if this is particularly true in international adoption. But for instance, you were called up and you were told, well, you could have this baby, they're a few months old.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to decide, well, do I want this baby or do I want to wait for another baby? What went through your mind when you got that phone call?
I think that the choice involved in adoption can feel quite agonizing, and it certainly did to me. It's uncomfortable. It doesn't feel the way it ought to be. There's something much easier about being pregnant and knowing that just this is the child that you were meant to have. So that choice is uncomfortable. On the other hand, I think that the element of choice in adoption is incredibly important, and the fact that all adoptive parents are consciously intending parents seems to me a very important thing. And indeed, it's a major reason I think the agencies should get out of the business of parental screening altogether. I think adoptive parents are, on the whole, very good bets as parents and better bets than biologic parents, half of whom probably didn't start as conscious intending parents.
Well, did you accept the baby that was a few months old?
Yes, that's my Christopher.
Once you got to Peru and accepted this baby, then you were told, well, we have a brand new infant we can exchange for the son that you've accepted. What a kind of bizarre thing, I suppose, to have to deal with.
Well, I was actually told when I first got to Peru that there were two children. I met Christopher, the slightly older child, first. And I, you know, think in a matter of some number of moments that it on some emotional level became clear to me that that was my child.
How did you tell?
I didn't have some moment at which I knew, I suppose, until I met the infant that very same night and realized that I had already bonded to Christopher and that he was my child and that I couldn't take this infant.
How old was Christopher?
He was 4 months.
Once you decided, you know, that Christopher was your son, then you had to live through what you describe as the peculiar form of torture reserved for foreign adoptive parents. What were some of the bureaucratic things in Peru and in the States that you had to go through?
Well, in the States, it's easier, of course, because whatever absurdities you have to go through, you're here, you live in your house, you have your friends, you go to your job. What's difficult abroad, I spent 2.5 months roughly with each adoption. What's difficult there is a couple of things. One is that you don't know the system and you don't have any of your supports around. I was entirely alone in Lima, except for the friends that I made there. The most difficult thing, though, is that you don't know, and this is true usually with foreign adoptions when you're in the foreign country, you don't know until the end of the process whether you'll be able to finalize the adoption and bring the child home, so that although in the first moments or the first hours or the first days you feel emotionally that you have completely become the parent of this child, you live for whatever period of time it is with this extraordinary anxiety that for any or no reason someone may simply lift this child and take it away. That's what really makes it overwhelming. The rest of it, the terrorist blackouts, the dealing with the police doctor medical exams and the psychiatric interviews in a foreign language you hardly understand, those things can be very difficult. Certainly the medical crises that I lived through were extraordinarily difficult, medical crises that my children lived through. But I think the worst of it is this anxiety that you may lose this child.
Let's take a short break here, then we'll talk some more. My guest is Elizabeth Barthelet. She's a professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, Family Bonds, Adoption and the Politics of Parenting. This is Fresh Air. Elizabeth Barthelet is my guest. She's written a new book about adoption and the politics of parenting. It's called Family Bonds. So both of your adopted sons are Peruvian. Now, in America, there's a lot of resistance to interracial adoption. And some of that resistance comes from African-American groups who think that if black children are adopted by white parents, that the children will lose their heritage and identity. For example, the National Association of Black Social Workers opposes interracial adoption. They say it robs black children of their heritage and racial identity. As the head of an interracial family now, what do you think?
Well, it may be predictable, but I believe in transracial and transnational families. I think it's one of the exciting things about adoptive families is that they cross all sorts of barriers, birth heritage barriers, as well as racial, national, and cultural barriers. My own sense is that the position of the black social workers is a position that's very harmful to the black children in this country who are waiting for adoptive homes.
Do you have, like, numbers, you know, the percentage of black children versus white children who don't get placed?
Sure. First of all, we have about 500,000 children now in foster care in this country, and about half of that number are children of color. The children of color wait much longer for placement, and they wait for longer period of time, even if they are eventually placed. We've got, I mean, the reason why current racial matching policies cause such problems for black children is that there's an incredible mismatch in the numbers here. We've got half the kids waiting for homes are children of color, and yet perhaps 90% or even more of the prospective parents waiting are white. There have been a lot of efforts in the last couple of decades to provide subsidies to African-American children to adopt same-race children and to reach out and to recruit. None of those efforts have even begun to produce the number of African-American children, I'm sorry, African-American parents that we need. And it's not because African-Americans don't want to adopt. It's because there's such a mismatch in the numbers. If you have half the kids in the system, kids of color, we just are not a nation with a population where half the prospective parents or anything like it are people of color.
You actually oppose matching in general in adoption agencies, you know, where the agency matches the potential parent and the child. If matching were done away with, what would the system be like?
I would hope what we then have is agencies that were putting their resources into getting the children who need homes together with the people who want to parent. And that seems to me the business that agencies should be in. I think they're both wasting their resources now and putting up tremendous barriers that prevent children from getting homes. And I don't think they're even accomplishing much of what they would like to think they're accomplishing. I mean, take, for example, the case of gay and lesbian prospective parents. They are officially excluded from adoption all over this country. I mean, they can slip through, but they're officially excluded by most agencies throughout the country. And yet, lesbian couples particularly are adopting at a rapid rate. Mostly, they're going through the system purporting to be straight singles, and the system is sufficiently limited in its resources and energy that it doesn't go out and investigate individuals or couples to find out what actually is their sexual orientation. So we have gays and lesbians adopting anyway. We also have a system that is pushing gays and lesbians into producing their own children through donor insemination, for example, where there's absolutely no barrier, no screening, no problem whatsoever.
But getting back to what the system would be like if the adoption agencies didn't match parents to kids, would the parents just come in and choose somebody? I mean,
they'd come in and get in line. I mean, I would let birth parents and prospective adoptive parents have choices and exert choices and decide what I'd let adoptive parents decide what kind of child they want to adopt and feel comfortable adopting. I'd have let the agencies, indeed, I'd encourage the agencies to provide advice, to encourage adoptive parents to do lots of soul searching. I'd encourage lots of education and counseling by the agencies. Indeed, I think that the agencies could do a lot better job on guiding parents toward the kind of child it makes sense for them to adopt if they would get out of the business of screening. In other words, if they'd give up their power and just put themselves in the education business, you would then have prospective parents who'd be willing to be honest with the agencies. Right now, prospective parents just think in terms of getting a good score on their home study, so they don't engage in the kind of open soul searching that I think is important for people who are entering into adoption.
You've been quoted in a couple of recent articles about cases in which the birth parent won back custody of a child from the adoptive parent. Mm-hmm. You've been quoted as saying that you think that we value biology over nurturing and that that's not right. We need to place more value on the amount of nurturing a parent has done.
I think that theme is really at the core of almost everything in the book. It's true. I do think that in general, in our society, we define parenting too much in terms of biology, and I think that has to do with why people dealing with infertility struggle so long and so hard to overcome infertility rather than moving on to adopt. I think it's why people thinking about parenting generally don't consider adoption to be one of the options that they think about rather than just naturally thinking automatically of creating their own biologic product. And I certainly think if you look at the whole process of children who were separated from their birth parents and whether we sever that bond legally and free them up for adoption, that we value biology too much. And my concern there largely is that we don't value the child's interest in a nurturing home nearly enough. I think we should value that first. And then I think when we think of parental rights, we shouldn't think just of the right to procreate. I think there should be a right to adopt, but I think that for both adoptive and procreating parents, we should think of parenting as more of a privilege than a right.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Barthollet is a professor at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, Family Bonds. This is Fresh Air.